Now and Again is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage, Keanu, and more, head on over to cageclub.me. That is cageclub.me. Please play this song on the radio. Please play this song on the radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a brief interruption in our countdown of Rolling Stone's top 100 songs of the century so far. We're taking a little detour at 50 to talk with friend of the podcast, Jarrett Brown. Jarrett, how are you?
I'm well, actually. Thanks for having me on for this part.
Well, you're kind of our resident knowledge guy, trivia keeper.
Kind of historian.
We have to answer three questions to cross the bridge or else we fly off into our deaths. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about Rolling Stone very briefly, kind of its history. It's peaks, its valleys, it's still clinging on to relevance today. What are your, personally, you know, before we get into the history, do you have any memories of Rolling Stone or any personal attachment to this publication?
I've been reading it on and off for years since high school / college, and it's always been the one thing I go to for music, basically. It's always been there for me. My first real memory of it is the 1999 Britney Spears cover. And then after that, okay, it's just kind of like been a mismatch of like who's been here, who's been there. And I'll actually tell you the interesting things when we get to them, but there has been some big changes recently.
Yes, there have, including an extremely controversial couple of years in the mid-aughts that we'll probably briefly touch on as we get into their politics. But just, you know, kind of first off, jumping into it, started in San Francisco in 1967. And yeah, it was a music magazine that kind of covered everything. And I feel like, you know, 67, it's pretty notable. And maybe partially why there hasn't been much in the way of change is because the publisher is still the same. This fella named is it Jan
Warner?
Jan Warner.
Yes. Yeah. So it was started after this Summer of Love, which was the biggest counterculture shift in history so far, and the first cover featured John Lennon in military gear for a movie he was doing, and it also covered the Monterey Pop Festival, which was like probably one of the biggest festivals besides Woodstock of that time frame, before Woodstock, yeah, I should say.
And I feel like, you know, it partially because, you know, print just is kind of dead now. But yeah, it really hasn't changed. It still very much has this kind of boomer feel to the magazine as a whole. It really still loves its old guard, as we talked about and we'll talk about on the countdown. But its politics have always kind of attempted to be a little bit, ever so slightly, out of the mainstream. You know, it's a boomer rag, so you would think maybe it leans conservative or you know, neoliberal, or even like you know, Sausalito conservative, basically. Like I guess what would now be more like Silicon Valley conservative, yeah, which I guess is just libertarian anyway. But I mean, it had people writing politics like Hunter S. Thompson. Matt Taibbi, who is very leftist, is still writing for it now, I believe.
Yeah, he is. Yep. Yeah, Hunter S. Thompson actually started in the late 70s. He, 1973 is when they switched over to politics at that point. Before that, they were just focusing on music. And Thompson was actually the biggest name at the time to be writing for Rolling Stone. And he would actually keep contributing until his death in 2005. So that tells you a lot about what he was doing. He knew what was going on, so he stayed on as a contributing writer after they kind of let him go a little bit. But he was still very relevant up until 2005.
You know, other writers, the sort of semi-fictionalized story of Cameron Crowe was, appeared in the film Almost Famous, that the magazine there is, you know, sort of supposed to be, a Rolling Stone-esque magazine as well.
And also you have Tom Wolfe, who wrote The Right Stuff, and the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test was also a big contributor to the political stuff as well, and that's where he got his start with that in Rolling Stone as well.
Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people have come through and had their careers launched by this. Lester Bangs is another one. You know, it was very ahead of its time at the time. And let's talk, yep, about that. What are some of the things in the early days of Rolling Stone that it was kind of really known for?
Well, as we mentioned before, Thompson was a big contributor to the political stuff. Mm-hmm. Fear and Loathing was published in Rolling Stone originally, and also his Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail was featured in it.
Which is a fantastic read and holds up. You can just change some words today and still see, still have the fear in every way.
As we mentioned too, Lester Bangs was a big deal. He wrote for only a couple years because Jan Warner didn't like the way he wrote things. So after like only 3 years, he fired him, let him go. But he basically bought Rolling Stone into what it was for music reviews. Cameron Curl, as we mentioned, was there too. And before the magazine format was big with them in 73, when they switched to the magazine format, it was actually a newspaper. Style, so it was a little weird because you would have it tucked under your arm and walk around campus with it, because apparently in the late 60s to early 70s, it was a rite of passage by college students to buy the magazine, which is odd.
So, you know, it's a general entertainment magazine now. You get movies, film, television, all kinds of that stuff, as well as politics again. Peter Travers, I believe, is still Rolling Stone's film critic, though he is bland as shit, in my opinion. He's like Gene Shalit without the fun puns.
Yeah, exactly. That was in the 1980s. They actually switched to that format. Prior to that, in 1977, Warner moved the headquarters of the magazine from San Francisco to New York, calling San Francisco cultural backwater, which is basically the biggest insult you can give, because San Francisco was at the time the cultural hotspot in the late 60s to early 70s.
And so when did it flip kind of to that? So my memory of it, and I know it's come back to this now, and it went away from this for a while. But I remember in my own memories of flipping through it at a Barnes Noble or wherever I was it was just like an oversized magazine, like it commanded space almost.
Yes, 73 was the year they switched to that format, and so that was the format almost for 83, 93, 2003. So for like 30 some odd years, it was that big oversized format. And then in 2008, October to be exact, they switched up to the standard magazine size. And that like really annoyed everyone, because you knew what Rolling Stone was when you saw it. But they wanted to be more discreet. And on that cover actually was the future president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Okay. Ah, interesting. We're gonna be a little bit all over the place. We're not going to go like a year by year thing on this. We're just going to kind of talk about some things that Rolling Stone has done and some trivia. I'm reading about Jan Werner right now, who I didn't honestly do any research for. Also, apparently, kickstarted Annie Leibovitz's career in some ways. But you know, I think maybe this is kind of the fact that he still owns so much of it and is so hands on. You know. When you've had this much success and been part of something so successful for, you know, nearly 50 years, over 50 years, it's just like, you know, it seems like he's unable to kind of roll with the time, roll with the changes. And also, you kind of become a capitalist. I'm reading, you know, for example here, in 96, he fired a critic who gave a Hootie and the Blowfish album, like the Hootie and the Blowfish album, a bad review. And his response was, I'm a fan of any band that sells 8 million records. So maybe we're getting a little bit of, you know, payola here, which is a well-known thing among print industries. It's, you know, Warner Brothers could very easily say, if you don't give this new Green Day album a good review, well, maybe, you know, we just stop advertising in there. And it's not like it payola like it was with the radio stations. But this is a thing that happens in print. And, you know, it's interesting to see this kind of, this boomer become the thing he hated, much like all boomers kind of did in a way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Annie Leibovitz. I was digging a little bit. December of 83, she shot John Lennon's last photo ever. And then 5 hours later, he was shot and killed by Mark David Chapman, who was recently denied for the 10th time.
Yes, parole. Because fuck that guy.
For the 10th time. Yeah, exactly. This was the last photo for Rolling Stone she ever took, because after that, she left and started doing her own thing. In the 70s, the most popular article of this time was the Patty Hearst adoption.
Oh,
and how she was supposedly brainwashed by the Liberation Front.
Yeah,
so that was like the biggest thing in Rolling Stone in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean that's something that I think is a little too much to get into for this show. Maybe it would be a fun maybe it'd be a fun episode for you and me to talk about in kind of a My Favorite Word Murder or like a Drunk History kind of B-side one day. That could be really fun.
Hilarious. That'd be amazing.
But if you don't know anything about the whole Patty Hearst thing, definitely Google that and take some time and read about Patty Harris. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, because that's a very fun rabbit hole thing. Because you just click around a little bit and you're like going down five different pages. Also in the about that time too, this is when Rolling Stone was starting to switch over to the Entertainment Weekly type format it's in now. So you'll see the shift start like right about here, and this is the first time that non-musicians were featured on the album cover, because before this it was nothing but musicians and no real actors or anything like that.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I got that vibe from reading. Oh, 2006, Rolling Stone released issue 1000, which is the biggest deal ever for them, because that's huge.
Wow, okay. I'm actually kind of shocked that it took that long to get to 1000. I guess that math works out. Here's a point. It's a monthly magazine. Has it always been a monthly magazine?
No, before this it was bi-weekly, so every other week it was putting out an issue, so you would get 2 issues a month with it. So that's why it took that long. It actually got there that quick, I should say, because every month you're getting one at the beginning of the month and at the end of the month, so you're looking at roughly 2 a month or 1 every other week. Right. So it went pretty quick to get to 1000, actually, in my opinion.
So when's the last time you read a Rolling Stone?
I actually have one, and I'm actually looking directly at it right now. I had to dig it off my off my floor because it was at the edge of my bed and I was reading it last night. I actually have the second issue of the revamped and revitalized Rolling Stone, which is now monthly officially.
Okay.
So last year Jan Warner sold his remaining share, which was 51% of the magazine, to Penske Media. And after this, they started to rebrand it and reformat it. The first issue featured Cardi. The first rebranded issue is July 2018, and that featured Cardi B and Offset on the cover.
Wow, that's going to be some trivia.
Yeah, that's trivia. I'm looking at it right now. Right. It's back to the oversized format, which is a good thing because you'll know it's Rolling Stone when you see it. It's also now monthly, like I mentioned, and there is a lot more. It's still very political, but it's also at the same time more of appealing to the millennial generation now too, because they have a lot more coverage with media and stuff like that. They still have the politics. I just opened to that by accident as I'm looking for the other thing, and they actually just switched over to more TV coverage because they're starting to realize now that millennials like TV. So that's a big deal.
Well, we are
in
the quote-unquote golden age of television.
Trying to find it. Oh, yep. And this one is actually Alan Siebenwall, who is
local
from
boy.
The Star Ledger here in New Jersey. He is now the head writer for TV writer for Rolling Stone. He has actually a very good article in here that I skimmed over briefly. And it's kind of a debate, which I agree with. Better Call Saul, better than Breaking Bad?
I'm sure there are people out there who are listening to this who are either nodding in agreement or punching like their car stereo right now. I haven't seen
and or flipping tape.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of Better Call Sauls because we have discussed our opinion on Breaking Bad on this show, which is that it's pretty good. It's just not the best show of all time. Which that alone gets people really angry is the fact that we are not getting extremely erect and trying to fuck our DVDs of Breaking Bad makes people very angry sometimes. And Siebenwall, if you've never read some Siebenwall, I highly recommend looking him up. He is a great television writer. He did get his start in a Central Jersey local rag and has really been working his way up. And he doesn't suck, honestly. He's one of the better. I discovered him when I was, well, because he's our local paper, but also when I was big into Lost during its initial run. And he didn't just have shitty takes on it and like conspiracy theories like everyone else did. It's intelligent TV writing, which there's not enough of, considering how, like you said, it's the golden age of television. Everyone's rushing to put out like weekly episodic recaps where a bunch of people just go, "This happened this week. Boy, I wish these two characters would kiss. That was a silly thing that happened." You need some depth here, and Siebenwall is actually pretty good at that.
Yeah, his two books, I have actually read both of them. The Revolution Was Televised, which is about probably from the start of Breaking Bad, from The Sopranos roughly to Breaking Bad, is actually really good. And then his second book, which is called TV the Book, is really good too. Him and another writer rank pretty much about every big TV show in the history of television into a top 200 or so list. And they I don't agree with the number one, essentially, but the everything after that is really good where it should be, like, plus or minus a spot or two. But he is a very good writer. His Sopranos coverage was phenomenal. I remember reading that, like, when I didn't have HBO to figure out what was going on.
I want to talk very briefly about some of the criticism that Rolling Stone has received, because we kind of cover this a lot, and, you know, if we haven't dug as deep into it in the countdown, we're going to dig deep into it in the future. And I do publicly, on air, want to shout out Jared Brown for, he was like, hey, you and me should do this top 100 thing. And I was like, yes, Nico and I will do it. And I do feel a little bad about that. But only just because Nico and I just, you know, it's you know, we felt that three people for that would take forever, and it's already taking forever. But you know, you are great at this kind of stuff, and thank you, and sorry for the idea for that.
I just basically said to myself when I asked you, oh, when are we recording this? You're like, oh, we did it. I'm like, oh well, no big deal.
No, okay. I did give you a heads up. I was like, hey, we did do this. But we already, it was kind of a Ozymandias thing, like I did it 32 minutes ago or whatever. But yeah. Some of the criticism that Rolling Stone has got, which we bring up, apparently they did a 500 greatest songs of all time at some point. A critic referred to it as an example of unrepentant rockist fogyism. Some other things that they have done, talking about how Rolling Stone always tries to kind of ride the current trend, but just is usually a little too late on it. Apparently, they really wrote off Led Zeppelin for most of the band's active years, and then in 2006 honored them as the heaviest band of all time.
Which is a sacrilege, because that should belong to Black Sabbath, in my opinion, yeah. But there is everybody
yes,
else.
Yes, I would agree with that. At least the first heavy band, maybe. But yes, for sure, they deserve more credit for the heavy in general. Also, if you just look at Rolling Stone's history, some have said that it, like, ignored hip-hop and ruthlessly panned heavy metal, two genres that would, in a few years, dominate the pop charts. And, yeah, and that's kind of where we talked about just how Rolling Stone has never really been with the time. They've always been kind of, like you said, it's kind of a neoliberal rag. It doesn't like to rock the boat too much. And it does kind of give a lot of deference to, you know, the old stalwarts, your U2s, your Dylans, things like that, your Springsteens.
And I also like to mention, you brought a controversy, the UAV rape story that supposedly happened.
That's exactly what
I have to touch on.
Sure, go ahead. Give us some background.
But so what basically happened was in, and I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for this, so this is, I'm basically going to summarize it. What supposedly happened in the November 19th, 2004 issue, there was an article published called A Rape on Campus, which was about a female student who was supposedly gang raped on the University of Virginia campus. It was a part of a hazing ritual in one of the fraternities. Apparently, as it turns out, it was all fictionalized and never really happened. Didn't really happen, because everyone who was at this party was like, hey, like, this didn't happen because this girl wasn't at this party.
And yeah, and it was huge. And I mean, this doesn't happen often. You know, fake rape stuff does not happen much. And when it does, it's pretty highly publicized. The Duke Lacrosse case from a couple years back, and Nancy Grace's like kind of public downfall is another example of that. For major publications and people with any kind of reach to publish this stuff and then be like, oh no, it was fakesies, just disgusting, top to bottom, wretched, unconscionable, does so much more harm in the long term. And they got fucked for it.
Yeah, I think I actually bought this issue. I don't know if it was like the way it was written or like the fact that a lot of the stuff seemed off, but then when everything started to come up, I'm like, oh, never mind.
They got hit with lawsuits from the dean of the associate dean of the school. They got hit with by graduates from the fraternity. And
the fraternity itself.
There's no results on Wikipedia of the student one, but they definitely did lose the one with the assistant dean.
Yeah. On November 9th, hold on here. At the end of the article, on November 9th, the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity filed a suit for $25 million for damages to its reputation caused by the magazine with reckless disregard for truth. Let's see here. Yeah, it looks like we don't know what happened with it
Which probably means it was a settlement.
Yeah, probably when, outside. When usually that happens, it usually means...
It means there's a contraction. Yeah. Like, it's just kind of can't talk about it usually. And they had to apologize several times. Honestly, this woman should... And this isn't... You know, you hear that, like, your description of it. And I mean, just from hearing it myself when it actually happened, I assume this was, like, a young writer like you did as well. Like, maybe, like, in her late 20s, early 30s, something like that. This is a 45, 46-year-old woman who has been writing for a pretty long amount of time. Like, who should absolutely know better? This isn't a Stephen Glass situation. Like, this is just willful... falsehoods. I guess that's what Stephen Glass was too. But this you should know better. This isn't a young person trying to get an edge up. And so I mean, you could look into that a little bit more. It's disgusting. It's really gross.
Yeah.
That person.
The whole Wikipedia article is like long. Yeah. Is like super long and like not even fun to. I'm like, yeah, I'll read that eventually. That's a deep dive. One night you had to do when you had the time.
Yeah, I mean, I always something that you know when people bring this up, something that I say a lot is It sucks when Donald Trump is right about things because he's always right for the dumbest fucking reasons. But journalism is, like, really bad right now. Like, journalism has been really shitty for the last couple of years. And there's a lot of contributing factors to that and not really something that is for this podcast. But, like, journalism is getting really, really fucking shitty. It's still happening. It's consistent. And one plagiarism thing is not an example of... Like, it's not a new thing. This happens a lot. I mentioned Stephen Glass. We see this. But, you know, a lot of the time journalists do a lot more damage than help the cause. And, yeah, it's unfortunate. But back to Rolling Stone being a magazine.
I'm also looking here. They... Where is it? I just saw something that was pretty cool. We could talk about the two... writers who they hired to the guys who broke the Goldman Sachs stuff.
Sure. Oh, Matt, yeah, yeah.
We had to touch on that because they are like some of the biggest things out there for this. So without them, we would have been in the dark with this stuff. So that is in 2000s. That is they hired them in the early 2000s. Michael Hastings, who is probably one of the biggest names in this now, he actually wrote an article before this. About which actually I'm actually interested in reading now, but I have to find it, called I Lost My Love in Baghdad, A Modern War Story. And apparently it's about a soldier who died in Afghanistan after being ambushed by gunmen. And like he wrote the whole thing about that. That wasn't Rolling Stone, excuse me. And that was pretty much his first big deal. And then he's now, oh wow, he's actually dead. He died in 2013 when he was in a car accident.
Oh, wow.
So Michael Hastings isn't writing for Rolling Stone anymore. Yeah. God bless him. I'm going to screw up his name because I'm I'm whiter than anybody. Matt Taibbi?
Taibbi, I believe, yeah.
Taibbi, thank you. Yeah, as I said, he's still contributing. He wrote a couple books recently. Actually, you'll love the name of this one, called The Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus.
Oh, geez. Well, you know, here's the two things I really remember about Taibbi. He's always been surprisingly leftist for a magazine that I find to be extremely neoliberal. And I remember when Andrew Breitbart died, he wrote an article basically saying, like, fuck that guy. Don't like, journalists shouldn't write about him just because he was also a journalist. Like, he fucking sucked. Fuck that guy. And he got a lot of blowback for that. And he was like, no. And, you know, it's relevant because, you know, John McCain just died. And we're seeing a lot of, like... mostly journalists and liberals being like, you know, he was one of the good ones. It's like, you're allowed to, you know, just FYI, folks, much like you're allowed to not like songs, as we've talked about on the show before, you can hate people for their politics. Just because people die doesn't mean, like, they were suddenly a good person or we should respect them.
Yep.
Like, people can suck. Like, John McCain fucking sucked and now he's dead and good. But also, Taibbi was one of the first people I remember to maybe around, like, September or October of 2016 to go, yo, Donald Trump can win this. Like, fucking look around, and you can't run a campaign on, hey, at least I'm not fucking this guy, right? Like, at least I'm not him. Look at this clown. You can't run a campaign on that. And he was one of the first people to be like, he could do this, guys. Like, what are you doing? You need to take this seriously. And yeah, no, he's got his finger on the pulse of politics for sure.
Yeah. the big article that he wrote is called, I had to look it up now, it's called The Great American Bubble Machine, which he described Goldman Sachs as a vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. So, yeah, that's pretty damn awesome. That's an awesome way to describe Goldman Sachs as well, too, which I still don't understand why they're around.
Yeah, and, well, hey, because no one got prosecuted after you know that whole thing. Big Short is a great movie on that, actually.
Yeah, 100%. We'll agree with that.
So yeah, I mean that's kind of the Cliff's Notes on Rolling Stone's ebbs and flows. Certainly not as relevant today as it was in say 1975. But what is the fact that it still exists is saying something at all.
And I'd also like to add that if Rolling Stone wasn't around, we wouldn't have the very, very now shitty, undersized alternative press, which is much now complete trash. I actually tried to look through it one day, and I'm like, I don't know any of these bands, so I'm not going to touch this ever again.
I imagine at this point, alternative press is either just, like, writing about bands with, like, extremely angular hair with names like Present at My Own Funeral or something like that. And or just like SoundCloud rappers who do a bunch of Xanax.
Yeah, pretty much. But Rolling Stone, at least it's still trying to stay relevant. Their website is actually better than a magazine now, in my opinion, a little bit here and there.
Oh, I didn't even think about the website. I haven't seen it in a while. Let's check it out.
The website actually went through a major redesign at this around earlier this year. So you pretty much get that new type of look to it, but it is pretty much the magazine and stuff like that, but they do have a lot of like news flashes essentially.
They actually reprinted a David Foster Wallace article on John McCain from 2000, which is pretty cool.
If I see that. Yep. But also they show like the cover feature, which is Eric Church this month. He's like the big one. He's on the cover of the magazine. But you also get a lot of like current music news. Like they're very big with that, so it's kind of like, hey, like let's publish this. Like there is, oh god, I had to read this later, a brief history of Willie Nelson and Frank Sinatra's bromance, which I actually kind of am interested in reading about because that sounds pretty damn cool.
And that is something that, you know, I think a lot of people maybe think that Rolling Stone is just reviews and entertainment stuff, but they do a decent amount of long form journalism, which is
pretty
interesting.
That's what they're really like. This is kind of like what they're starting to be known for. Like they're taking the BuzzFeed formula and essentially putting it into a more pop culture format, whereas BuzzFeed will like let you write anything you want. Rolling Stone wants you to write mostly about entertainment stuff, so this is definitely like one of those things where I'm going to be like, okay, let's see, because they were both active during the same time frame, so who knows how interesting it could be.
I guess that's kind of it. A lot of people are probably listening to this and being like, yeah, I know what Rolling Stone is, but you know, I think there's people who have kind of lost any kind of awareness of print media, and just because we grew up when Rolling Stone was like vaguely relevant doesn't mean that, you know, your Jonas and friends of the show who are significantly younger, they have no reason to know what Rolling Stone is. And it's something that I think is a very Rolling Stone mindset for when you hear people be like, you don't know who Led Zeppelin is. You don't know who you don't know. You never listen to a Beatles song. It's like just because they were popular or it was a thing doesn't mean like you're obligated to know what it is. If it's not your generation, like you weren't there. Like there's no reason that you need to go backwards. I think you should just for history and knowledge and context. But like I don't think any 20-year-old needs to know what Rolling Stone is, and I wouldn't be shocked if some of them don't. And that's kind of why we just kind of summed up what it is and what it's been doing, and hit some bullet points before we jump back into the top 50.
It needs to be discussed because it is a very important thing, and also the cultural mindset, I should say. Because without Rolling Stone, we wouldn't have the Modern Review, essentially.
Yeah, and that's Rolling Stone. It's named after a Dylan song. That could have told you everything that we really needed to know about it.
Or a Muddy Waters song, depending on who you ask. And also the saying, Rolling Stone gathers no moss.
Sure. Jared, where can people find you?
Oh, what can I? You can find me at my name, Jarrett Brown, one word, on Twitter and Instagram. So if you want to give me a follow there, I would love it.
yeah, thanks for coming on. And we will, we've already talked about when you'll be back, but everyone else will be hearing you talk with me about Tony Hawk 2 in a couple of months. So we're going to dig back into the video game soundtrack library and talk about a game that we both loved about half of our lives ago.
Half, God, wow, I'm old.
Yeah, let's go die, just like Rolling Stone.
Never.
And you can find me at Chris Podcasts on the old Twitter. Rate and review the show, iTunes, or wherever you get it. Leave an awesome review for us so that more people can listen to us complain and we can make boomers mad when they find us shit-talking Rolling Stone and everything else that they love. CageClub.me for all good things. I was just on an episode about Mad Max. My season of Cinemakers about Christopher Nolan is coming to an end. And, of course, Now and Again, finishing up the top 50 Rolling Stone songs of the century thus far. And until then, when I'm back with Nico talking about 50-1, catch you on the flip side. One more time, yeah. Go ahead, you want to hit it like it did on the top, fellas? Hit it like it did on the top. Hit it now. Bobby. Yeah, how does it feel? I feel good. Yeah, how does it feel? I knew that I wouldn't. Like a rolling stone. Like a sex machine. Like a rolling stone. Like a sex machine. Like